What it is that I want to talk to you about today is that I sometimes call this little presentation the things that I never learned in seminary. I had the privilege, as many of you have had or are having, to go to a Bible school and then on to seminary. And somewhere in the midst of that, there were some things that I didn't learn. I never learned how to build relationships with people. In the kind of way that would be required of me in the roles that I've had to play, because I'm working with literally, thousands of people every year, and I want to have an impact in their life, and I want to be able to share something that basically has some meaning, but I didn't know how to go about doing that. And so consequently, I had to figure it out as you're figuring it out perhaps in your ministries even today. How do we reach students on a campus who we didn't know even existed a few years ago, and now they come to our universities and we see them and we meet them and we feel called of God to really minister into their lives. But how do we go about building relationships with them to the point where they're going to be more receptive to what it is that we have to say? And I've come to believe that the work of development, and that's what it is that I do, is called. And I suppose they had to figure out a name for it, so we're going to call it development. And it probably implies any number of things in our minds, what that word might mean in our context. But essentially, and the way that I define development is that it represents the things that we're doing on a fairly regular basis in all of the ministries that we represent. That the development, as I define it, represents the things that we're doing to build rational relationships with others. In other words, we exist for, our ministry is basically focused on how do we build the kinds of relationships that are going to enable us to be effective in sharing, the message that really burns in our souls to share with others. And I have come to believe that at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, the only thing that really matters and the one thing that's going to determine how effective we've been is going to be predicated on how effective we've been in building relationships. And we all know how important relationships are. If I were to go around the room and say, well, tell me about, what it is that has brought you to this place in your life that you would be here in Poland and at the European Leadership Forum. If you were to tell your stories, and we all have a story to tell, don't we? But if you were to tell your stories, eventually we come down to talking about people that had an impact in our lives, people that, pushed us on to do something that otherwise we might not have been willing to do. They encouraged us along the way to take a step of faith, to do something that we wouldn't have normally have felt comfortable in doing. They had confidence in us when we had lost it. And I think I have stories to tell of, not really feeling like I had the ability to be able to do what it is that I was going to do. And someone said, no, you do. And they kind of pushed me to do something that was way outside my comfort level. But all of our stories are stories of relationships. Moms and dads and teachers and pastors and friends and acquaintances and people that have had an impact in our lives. And basically, we're all kind of a complex composition of relationships that have been used of the Lord to bring us to where it is that we are today. And so we just think relationships are important. Oftentimes when I'm in a group setting like this, I'll ask people to think of a word or two that basically expresses what makes a relationship really precious. And people will come up with interesting words like we have shared interests, and that's certainly true, isn't it? The people that you have a relationship with, be it your best friend or your spouse, you share common interests. You have fun with that person. You feel safe in that relationship. And that's really an important part of it, isn't it? Feeling safe that you can share anything without being rejected. And knowing that that person, regardless of what your circumstances may be at the time, still cares for you and really is, deeply involved in your life. And the defining characteristic of a relationship, though, and this is really important to remember, that the defining characteristic of a relationship is that it's reciprocal. In other words, both parties benefit from a relationship, or otherwise you don't have a relationship. What you have is an arrangement. And a lot of organizations, we have arrangements with people. You know, a lot of charitable organizations have arrangements with donors. And the arrangement simply is that if you send us money, we're going to be really nice to you. And we're going to send you letters, and we're going to, you know, affirm you and your commitment to our organization. And we're going to send you a Christmas card and maybe even a birthday card. And we're going to stay in contact with you until you stop giving. And then you never hear from the organization again. And then perhaps if that's been your experience, you kind of feel manipulated, don't you? You feel used, that somebody was really, you know, pursuing you, not because they wanted to know you, but they wanted what it is that you could give to them. And that can happen in ministry. That if a student rejects us in a campus situation, and we just kind of say, okay, we're going to go on to the next one because you're not important to us unless you receive us in the ways that would be consistent with our desires, then essentially what people feel is that, well, you don't really care about me. You know, what you care about is a number on a sheet of paper, that this is a convert who basically has come to Christ as a result of our ministry. And I'm not suggesting that it should be as crass as that or is as crass as that, but the point is there is a difference between a relationship and an arrangement. And there are some marriages that, quite frankly, are arrangements. And, you know, people marry, and essentially, you know, there's, it could have been articulated or not articulated, it really makes no difference, but we kind of put a line on a piece of paper. And, you know, imagine this happening on your honeymoon. You're just, you know, the day before, or standing in front of this beautiful person, if you're a man, or this handsome guy as a woman, and you're standing there and you're saying, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, until death do us part. And you're doing it with longing eyes of love and compassion and caring, and you kiss the bride, and then you drive off to your honeymoon. And imagine the next morning getting up at the breakfast table and saying, no. You know, there's a few things that we didn't talk about, you know, when we were dating, but now is probably a good time to do that. So let me just take out a sheet of paper, and you walk over to a table and grab a sheet of paper, and you draw a line down the middle of the piece of paper, and you put her name on one side and your name on the other side, or vice versa. And you say, okay, now, I'm the guy, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to work in my profession. I'm going to be successful. I'll generate money. I golf, you know, 2 days a week, just, you know, want you to know that. I'll make sure that you get what it is that you need in order to be able to do the things that you need to do. So this is what I'm going to do, and that's me. And over here is you, and so now here's what it is you're going to do. You're going to have babies. You're going to raise them. You're going to clean the house. You're going to do the laundry. You're going to do this, all the other things. And I promise you that I'm not going to go over in your side of the paper, and you don't need to go over in my side of the paper. This is where we're going to have this wonderful, happy, married life. You do your thing, and I'll do my thing, and don't cross the line. Because the moment you cross the line, then we're going to have trouble. Now, how many of you just feel warm and fuzzy about that? I mean, if you can imagine sitting in that situation and you're saying, hold everything. You know, I'm not sure that's what I signed up for. And, you know, because I don't see it that way. But, you know, there were a lot of it, and that's obviously an absurd illustration at one level, but in practice it oftentimes happens that way. And we have this arrangement, as long as you play by the rules, then everything's going to be okay. But if you violate the rules, then we're not going to, you know, obviously have a relationship. So relationships are important. And I think most of you have discovered that, you know, that when you've experienced real impact in the life of another person through ministry, you can go back and you can track back the fact that, you know, our relationship was built, trust was built, confidence was built, people knew you cared, people knew you loved them, people knew, you know, that you were not just approaching them for a statistical number that you could add to a tally sheet, but that basically, you know, they were an important part of your life and the desire of your heart. Now, there was another word in my definition, and you'll remember that, because I said it's the things that we do not only just to build relationships, but to build what I call rational relationships. And the point that I want to bring here is this, is that rational implies objectivity in this particular example. In other words, you have a relationship that is substantive, it's rooted in something that's more than just emotional. There's a statement, I think one of the great analogies of development is falling in love. Because, and oftentimes I speak on this topic, you know, every day, you know, literally probably in one form or another. I've traveled all around the world talking about the things that I'm talking to you about. And the thing that I want to remind people is that if you really want to understand development, then just, first of all, this isn't complicated. This is like easy, all right? So the first thing you need to understand is that, you know, what I'm going to talk to you about today, this isn't hard. This is just like really, really, really easy. And I'm not being facetious. This is really easy. And the other thing that makes it really easy is the fact that we're all experienced. You have all experience of development because you've all fallen in love. And if you can figure out what it is that would take two people who didn't even know each other to a point that on average, at least in my country, is less than 1.5 years or 18 months, that within 18 months of meeting somebody that you never knew before, you're standing in front of a pastor and you're saying, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health until we die. Now, what in the world happened in 18 months or less that would cause you to commit yourself to another person for the rest of your life? And if you can figure that out, then you understand development. It's just that easy. And I'm not being facetious because we're going to kind of break it out in the kinds of terms that I think will be really helpful to you. Now, I have a wonderful example in my parents because my parents were deeply in love with one another. My mother died 6 days before their 70th wedding anniversary. And so they lived with one another for 70 years. And my mother lived for 10 years at the end of her life with Alzheimer's disease. She was stricken with Alzheimer's disease, and she did not know any of us for 10 years, including my father. You know, the real tragedy of Alzheimer's is you lose your loved ones twice. And I remember the day vividly when I walked into the nursing home, get off the elevator in the Alzheimer's level. My mother was walking in this direction. I was walking towards my mother, and she walked right past me. And it was probably the worst day of my life because this was the woman that I had known, who was a visionary, who was smart, who was witty, who was gave me so much of what it is that I enjoy today and experience today, and I'd lost her. Most Alzheimer's victims die from malnutrition. They don't die from Alzheimer's. That's not a disease that necessarily is fatal, but usually they die from malnutrition. They just stop eating. And somehow my dad heard about that, and he was determined that my mother was not going to die from malnutrition. And so for 10 years, every day, he would go to the nursing home to feed my mother. And she didn't even know who he was. Now, I have seen pictures of my parents before they were ever married. They both looked like they'd swallowed a canary, you know, they just like grinning from ear to ear. You know, as a child, you look at your parents that way and you think, oh dear, I'm not sure that I ever remember them that way. But they were just so in love with one another. And on the last day I saw my mother, I went to the nursing home with my dad. And I hated to do this. I would do anything to avoid going to the hospital to see my mother because it was such a distressing period. I'd have to wait and prepare for like 3 months before when I knew I was going, just to get ready for it. And I went and I walked into the nursing home and my dad said, just sit down here. And so I just sat down. I went over and kissed my mother and held her for a little bit. She was almost semi-comatose. And my dad went over and he put his arm underneath her head, pulled her close, and he took a little wet washcloth because she had drainage from her eyes, and he would wipe that away. And then he always carried some like chapstick or Vaseline and put it on her lips because they were really dry. And he'd kiss her and love her and say, hey, honey, I'm here and I love you. And then he'd put her head down gently and he'd go and get the food. Well, the food was just like blender food. You know, I mean, the only reason you knew a pea was a pea was because it was green. Okay, so here's this little green glob over here, and this is orange glob here because that's carrots, and you know, and then this thing that looks like wallpaper paste was, you know, fish of some kind. It was just kind of blended up, but he would taste it to see if it was too hot or too cold, and then he would do something that was particularly loving. He'd take a salt shaker and he'd just put salt all over everything because we like salt in our family. Now, for those of you that are concerned, my blood pressure is like 110 over 60 or something. It's like really low. So if it wasn't for salt, I'd perish. At our house, it was, you know, let's thank the Lord for the food. And as soon as we said amen, it was somebody saying, pass the salt, please, before we ever tasted anything. So we were just putting salt in everything. So my dad put salt on my mother's food because he knew that's what she liked. And then he'd feed her. And he'd put food in, and she'd spit it out, and he'd put it back in, and she'd spit it out, and he'd put it back in. And it was a long ordeal, but she ate. I promise you, she ate. And then at the end, he'd wipe her face, and he sat down next to the bed that day, and he held her hand. And he's talking to her like I'm talking to you. He says, well, honey, you know, Jerry's home, and, you know, you got to watch Jerry when he's home, so he's got to go back and get some ice cream, because he's certainly going to want some ice cream when we get home tonight. And you know, and he'd sit there and talk with her, and then he'd pray with her. And she's like not even there. I mean, like, she's there, but she's not there. Then he'd kiss her goodbye, say, well, I'll be back tomorrow, sweetie. And he'd give her a hug and a kiss, and then put her head down. And we left. And we're driving home. Now, this is after 10 years of having done this. We're driving home, and he's driving, and I'm just in the passenger seat, and he drives up this long driveway, half-mile driveway, up to our house, and he doesn't say much because my dad is from Maine, and if you know anything about New Englanders, they're not really wordy. And I looked at him and I said, Dad, I don't know how you do this. And he didn't say anything to me. Just drives to the end of the driveway, stops. Opens the door and he looks over at me and he said, you know, 70 years ago, I stood in front of your mother in your grandmother's living room. Oh, she was so beautiful. And I looked into her eyes that day and I said, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, and sickness and in health until death do us part. And he gets out of the car. Now, I'm like a basket case. I'm sitting over on the other side thinking, oh, my word, that's all I needed to hear, Dad. And he leaned down and he said, and I meant that. And he closed the door and went into the house. Now, that's what I mean by rational. You see, the emotion never left. It's emotion that brings us together into a relationship, and it's rationalism that keeps us there. And that's the connection. Whether it's with an individual that you're working with on a college campus or in a church environment or wherever you find yourself, it's emotion that will bring you together. When you fell in love, it was emotion was the first thing that you felt. It's emotion that brings us together. But it's rationalism, that kind of objectivity, if you please, that keeps us there. And I want you to know that rationalism doesn't displace emotion. Okay? It doesn't say, okay, we're going to be emotional now, and then we're going to lose emotion, and we're going to be real rational in the relationship. Listen, I get off an airplane, you know, next Thursday, and when I stand on the curb waiting for my wife to come and pick me up, when I see the car coming around the corner to pick me up, my heart beats a little bit faster because the girl that I love is coming to pick me up. The emotion doesn't go away, it only grows deeper. And what we're trying to do in the developmental process is to replicate, you know, what it is that we already know about. Now, I'm going to, you know, I know a number of you are in the organizational development workshop that I'm teaching, and for those of you that are there, there are going to be some replication here, and so I apologize for that. But you know, that's always a good learning experience as well, so you'll forgive me. But the point that I want to make is this, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to build these kinds of relationships. And I'm going to show you a little bit how that's done. I'm not going to stick quite as closely to the notes as perhaps you would like. And I know that that's frustrating to people that are real note takers and you're thinking, oh no, he's left the process. I don't know where he is now. Just relax. Okay, we'll get there. Okay, but I want to, I've written a number of books and that's, they're not all that good. Okay, so I've written a number of books and basically to talk about this process. And most of them are, many of them are available downstairs and at the bookstore and you can see them there. But basically, the first book that I had written in this particular arena of activity was a book that was entitled Funding Your Vision, which was sold extremely well, and basically it was talking about fundraising. How do you raise money? But I wrote another book later, a few years ago. I mean, actually, a few years later. It's probably been about 10 or 15 years ago now, which is entitled Transforming Culture, The Church at Work in the World. And basically what I did in that book was I tried to take the concepts of development that I have used to help people understand the fundraising process and said, you know, it's no different. We're still building relationships with a purpose in mind. And so, and I talked about transforming culture because the anecdotal story that I tell in the book is a story of a church, and it's actually a combination of churches that I was looking at that basically were making a difference, so much of a difference that virtually the culture in the communities where they were existent and serving was virtually discernible. In other words, it was clear that this organization was having such an impact on their community that the whole culture of the community changed. And everybody knew it. And it seems to me that should be the case with all of our ministries. If there's not a corresponding change in the culture of the communities that we serve, then the realities are we're not really accomplishing what it is that God intended for us to accomplish. Because basically the gospel is transformational and it does relate in change. And so I wrote this book, and actually there it's anecdotal. I write the story in an anecdotal way, so it's there's people involved and they're talking to one another, okay? And so the one of the primary character in the book is a journalist who is a cynic and who has become growingly cynical in his cynicism, only because he's seen hurt, he's seen pain, he's seen all the things that a reporter will see. And in order to deal with it, he just became cynical about life. And he's like ready to quit everything. And his editor comes to him and he says, you know, I got an assignment. He says, I don't know if I'm going to continue to do this. He says, well, don't worry about it. He says, but I've got an assignment for you. And he mentions, he says, there's this church and it has basically changed the whole culture of a community. And I want you to go and I want you to research what happened. Because, you know, this isn't common. What it is that's happened here is not common. And I really want to know what is different about this church that makes such an uncommon result, you know, reflected in just a change in the culture of a community. And so the guy agrees to do it. And so he goes and he talks with the church. And there are two things that, the two aspects of this, and this is where it is we want to go here today. The first thing, you know, he wanted to know is what was the church doing to prepare and equip people for works of ministry. Because it seems to me that that's one of the core purposes of the Church of Jesus Christ as stated in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 10 through 12. That we're training and equipping people. This is a place where we get equipped so that we can go out and serve. And so, you know, the part of the book talks about what it is that happened internally to prepare and equip people. And externally, how they strategically deployed people in the world to reach, you know, their world with the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so it takes all the developmental principles that we're talking about and applies them in a situation which is common to all of us. We want to have an impact on the lives of people that shows. In other words, that it just is not happening. You know, we have, you know, 45 conversions, but nothing really happens on the campus. Nothing really happens in the community. Nothing really happens in the church that is demonstrative, practically speaking, of the work that's been done. And so that's, you know, where it is that we're going today. Now, you know, first of all, and here's a statement that I make in that book, and I will make here this morning, which I think is, or this afternoon, because I think it's a really important statement. And that is that success catches most organizations by surprise. And I think probably you can testify to this in one form or another. You know, success catches us by surprise. I mean, occasionally we have a student in our campus ministry. Occasionally we have a person in our church that gets saved, radically saved. And they want to go out and they're just rushing out to share their message of their salvation now with all of their friends. And it's kind of rare. It doesn't happen all that often. And so when it happens, we're just like thrilled. And these now become our poster children, right? I mean, these we're going to say, well, look at this is so-and-so. And I mean to tell you, he got it. And when he got it, I mean, he did it. And you tell the story and you want to show everybody the person, the picture of the person who personifies practically what it is that your ministry is all about. But yet there are probably 100 other people that were in the same group that this person was in that didn't have the same experience. But you don't show that to people. You just show them the one that's really making the difference. Because we're kind of surprised by that. Wow! I mean, this stuff really works. The Spirit of God can be transformational in a person's life. And this person can, you know, use his giftedness to further the cause of Christ in ways that are going to be compatible with his giftedness and his passion and so forth. I mean, it can happen because we've seen it happen. But we don't see it happen very often. And one of the statements that's made is the newspaper reporter comes to the pastor of the church that's really transforming the culture, you know, that has been used of the Lord to do the things that have been accomplished. He looks at the pastor one day and he says, "You're not surprised by success, are you?" And the pastor responds, "No, we expect it. We expect it. And we planned for it." Now, I have to admit that the book, you know, got mixed reviews. There were some people that loved it. I mean, some people just thought, this is just like the greatest book ever. I mean, and they were just, you know, affluent in their praise for what it is that I tried to do. And there were other people that were equally as destructive. They said, he is taking this work of the Spirit of God out of the hands of God and trying to do it himself. And I'm thinking, and I was crushed. I mean, I'm just thinking, man, I wish I could have gotten the addresses of everybody that said that, because I would have gone to their home and asked forgiveness for not doing a good job in trying to communicate what it is I wanted to communicate. Because I know that the work of the Spirit of God only can regenerate a soul. But I do think that we can create environments, that we can set the table in such a way that what's on the table is going to be appealing. And so all I'm talking about is how do we set the table in a way, you know, that it's going to be appealing. And I think we can set the table by a life well lived. People who have purpose, people who have, and basically, you know, as people see people who have purpose and who have been transformed by the Spirit of God, then when we begin, and I think it's enhanced, you know, when we've taken the time to build a relationship. Because that's all that this congregation did, was they just were really good at building relationships with people to the point where they were being responsive to ministry in ways that they wanted to act upon ministry because someone had taken the time to build a relationship. Now, all that being said, let's talk about relationships real quickly. And I'm here to say, and one of the things that I said earlier as we began, is that this is the one thing that there wasn't a soul in seminary talked to me about. And if you're a seminary grad, my guess is you didn't get the course in relationship building either. And so we kind of figure it out on our own, don't we? I mean, we kind of figure, okay, this is like important because we've discovered that to the extent that we have relationships with people, they tend to respond and they tend to be more responsive to what it is that we have to say. And so I want to draw you a diagram. And again, I like to draw pictures because people kind of relate to pictures, and I'm kind of a picture person. So usually when I write notes, they're usually little pictures, and I say, okay, well, I'm going to talk about this picture. And if you go into my session, if you're in the organizational development session, you're going to get a whole packet of pictures. I think I'm going to create a coloring book, actually, for development people, because I think we need it. But so here's one picture that I like to draw. And this is my wife, Sue, okay? And, of course, Nick knows her, so he knows that looks like Sue a lot. And this is Jerry, okay? And this is Sue and Jerry before they even knew each other existed, okay? Didn't have a clue. I mean, I grew up 1,200 miles from where Sue lived. And I grew up, my dad was a fisherman and a factory worker, you know, but he was a lobsterman, for those of you that are familiar with, you know, the vocation of people who work and live in Maine next to the ocean. And Sue's dad was a factory worker. He was a tool and die maker in a car factory in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is like 1,200 miles away. I mean, we were opposites. She's Polish. I'm U.S. American. And so, I mean, and really, you know, when we got married, these differences became really quite interesting, because I didn't realize that kielbasa is a Christmas, you know, instead of turkey, we have kielbasa, you know, and oh, I mean, to tell you, and I remember one day we were listening, you'll have to, and Sue's, her family was so Polish, and so one day we have a record on, and they're playing Roll Out the Barrel, you know, that song, Roll Out the Barrel, we're gonna have a barrel of fun, and Sue listened, and she says, "What are you playing Christmas music for?" I said, "Well, I didn't know this was a Christmas music song." She said, "Oh, yeah, Christmas at our house. You know, we have the Christmas dinner, and then we roll up about middle of the afternoon. We'd roll up the carpet, and we'd start dancing. And I mean, they're loud, they're gregarious, you know, and I'm kind of like quiet. And so it's been really, I'm doing quite well. I mean, you guys would be really proud of me. I can actually be a good Polish guest these days. The one thing, I don't know if this is unique about Poles, but, and this is getting off the topic, but I do that periodically, but, you know, Poles, at least my experience with Poles, is that when they get together as a group, they're like all talking, like everybody, and you have, there's like a whole people in a circle, and everybody's talking, and everybody's involved in everybody's conversation, which is really hard. I don't know how it's done. And so the first family meeting that Sue ever takes me to, the whole family's in a circle and everybody's talking. And Sue's involved in like six conversations at the same time. And I'm sitting over here and I want to say, okay, let's time out. Okay, now you have something to say. Let's listen to what we have to say over here. You know, and let's listen to what you have to say over here. I just want to get order to the thing, but that's not the case. And I've learned to live with chaos. It's been very, very good for me. And maybe that's not characteristic of all Poles, but somehow all the ones that I meet kind of relate to the story. But here we are, two people totally different. And here we are, 10 months later. Okay, you follow me? 10 months later, from the moment I saw her for the first time, we're standing in front of a pastor saying, "For richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, until death do us part." And you know the question that you need to answer is, what happened? What happened in 10 months that would cause me to look at her and irrevocably, without anybody having a gun to my head, saying, "I'm willing to live with you, I want to live with you, I intend to live with you for the rest of my life." And if you can figure that out, you're well on your way to really understanding what development's all about. So let me tell you what happened. The first thing that happened is we were brought to a place where we saw each other for the first time. And it was, in our case, my sister had known Sue. She had thought that Sue was a good match for her brother, and she knew me pretty well. We were only 2 years apart in age, and she called me one day, and she says, "I've got a girl that I really want you to meet." And she set it up for us to meet, and she was right. But we were brought to a place for the first time, and I can remember where she was standing. I can take you to the place where we were. It was my sister's house, and she was standing at this one spot. I came up the stairs here. She was there. She had long, dark hair. She had the braces on her teeth. She sparkled when she smiled. She was witty. She was smart. She was intelligent. She was, I mean, this is like, whoa. I mean, like, this is not like the typical experience that I've had in the past in other meetings that had been arranged, but this was really something special. And so we met for the first time. I'm going to kind of work through these, and then we'll kind of go back and analyze how it looks in ministry. And then the second thing was we had a first date. And that was like pretty important. I mean, I have met a lot of people that I, you know, at that time in my life that I enjoyed, but I never, you know, asked them out. But in her case, I called her like the next day. And I said, this is Jerry. You remember me? I was the guy you were with last night. And she said, oh, yeah. How are you? Doing fine. I says, well, I've got some tickets to a show. And I was wondering if you'd like to go. And we could go out and, you know, get something to eat afterwards. And she said, yeah, that'd be great. And so, like, I'm, like, really excited because she said yes, okay. Yes, which, by the way, is a rational decision. Yes and no are rational choices. You could say no, you could say yes, but you have to make a choice. And that's very important in concept and development. Don't misunderstand how important that is, because people need to make choices. And she said yes. So we went out on this next date, and we went to the show, and we had a nice dinner. And then we talked about ourselves, which is quite common in those relationships. I mean, you know, the predominant words, you know, were personal pronouns. I'm talking about me, okay? And she's talking about her. And I'm trying to convince her that I'm really a good deal. I mean, like, you know, I'm kind of a jock, you know, and I'm swaggering. I'm trying to do anything just to get her, you know, get her attention. You know, yeah, I'm a good guy, and I don't kick dogs, and, you know, I love my mother, and I open doors for girls, and, so, you know, whatever the case might be. And she's kind of like doing the same thing, but she's a little, you know, women are much more subtle about it, you know. But she just kind of leaves you enough guessing room to try to figure out what it is. That's just a trick that you girls have learned to do by, I don't know how you do it. But anyway, but she's telling me about herself too, and that she's, you know, I went to, you know, University of Wisconsin, and then I went to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and got a master's degree, and then I went on to Rosemead School of Psychology and got another master's degree, and then I went on to Rosemead School of Graduate School and got a PhD, and I'm thinking, good night, I'm so out of class here. But she's trying to convince me of the same thing, that she's worthy of my attention. Well, the next thing that happens is we have a second date. Now, this is really important, because if we didn't have these two things, these three things didn't happen, we'd never have gotten here. And the second date was, I'm kind of like interested, you know, I'm at least interested enough that I will say yes again. And so we had this second date. Now, let's stop here, okay? We're going to kind of go backwards a little bit. Those are the three most important steps in building a relationship. If I was, in the campus ministry, if I was, you know, doing evangelism in the communities where my church is located, you know, whatever the ministries are, the first thing is that you want to bring people that you don't know into a situation where they are exposed to who you are and what it is that you're trying to do organizationally. And you do that on campus ministries. You have, you know, special events, you know, where new students can come in and be exposed to your students in your chapter of IFES chapter. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, things that you can do to bring people together. And you suggest it, you know, with the students in your, that, you know, that are part of your group. You know, here's some things that you can do. You know, we're going to have this special event with somebody, and, you know, invite, you know, two of your friends. And so they come. And so that's really important. You need to bring people, you know, together. And then the first date is really encouraging to make a commitment to move from here to here. In other words, you know, we have something in your dorm that we think it would be really, really neat for you to, you know, give some consideration to. It's every Tuesday morning, and we meet, you know, someplace, And, you know, we're just talking about some topic that would be of interest to them. And we have this great guy coming into town. I'd love for you to come. I think you'd really, really enjoy it. And then you follow up and, you know, encourage them to come. But you want to get them to that first event. And then the second date is something else that you're inviting them to attend or some other activity that you feel that they might be interested in. But the point is that all these things, you know, have to occur relatively quickly in the developmental process. You remember I said it's emotion that brings us together. It's rationalism that keeps us together. And you know what the problem with emotion is that it's fleeting. I mean, have you ever been so angry, you know, that you just, I'm sure we all have been angry to the point where we just kind of lose it. I mean, and we're just not even being rational anymore. And you know what that is like. I mean, just get angry and then the next day somebody says, gosh, you were just like really mad. Why? And you say, yeah, I really was. I can't really remember why, but at the time it just really, you know, got me exercised. And because emotions are really fleeting, you just kind of feel good and then you feel bad. And it can be really immediately. And you can, you know, you go to a movie and you can be crying one moment and laughing the next, you know, because that's what happens in life. So emotion is an important part of the process, but you need to move it forward, you know, so that people, you know, become more rational in the relationship than what they might be, at least initially. So step number one, you know, is, you know, let's bring people together. Step number two is let's do something that would be somewhat analogous to a first date. How can we move everyone from there? Hey, listen, thanks for coming. You know, you drink coffee? Yeah, I drink coffee. Well, listen, why don't we meet tomorrow afternoon? Let's go over to Starbucks or go over to the coffee shop and have a latte together or, you know, an espresso. Yeah, that'd be great. See, that's something you could do right on the spot. Or encourage all your members of your group to say, you know, you see somebody in church this week or you see somebody in group this week that's new. We want everybody when you see one, you know, let's invite them to coffee the next day. Meet for coffee. You know, yeah, let's do that. And, you know, just, you know, that would be the equivalent of a first date. And maybe the second date is, hey, listen, I'm going to go to the Bible study up in my it's going to be in my dorm. You know, it's going to be on Tuesday evening. Can I come by and pick you up and let's go together? Because I'd love for you to experience it. I think you'd really enjoy it. And so that's like a second date. But it all has to happen pretty quickly because the good feelings that may have come out of this are going to evaporate. Okay? So this is like really important. And then, you know, it looks like this from then on out. And every one of these little intersecting points were events. It might be that, you know, we go out and meet her parents, and I go out and meet, you know, she goes out and meets my parents, and then I have to meet her friends, and she wants to meet my friends. And then we, you know, go on lots of other dates, and we spend nights in restaurants talking until they kick us out, you know, just learning and, you know, understanding each other a little bit better. And every time, you know, the further we move down this continuum, the more revelatory we become. In other words, I wouldn't tell her on my first date, you know, that I'm scared of heights. You know, that's not really very manly, you know, so I'm not going to tell her about that. But somewhere along the way, I said, don't ask me to get up on a ladder more than 10 feet because I panic, you know. And really, you're scared of heights, really? Yeah, I really am. Oh, well, my golly, so am I. Well, that's good. We're not going to go bungee jumping, okay? So there are certain things that you don't talk about until you know that it's safe to talk about them. So safety is really important. That, you know, that it's not normal, but it happens occasionally when somebody, you know, in the first meeting just blurts out everything. And sometimes when that happens, you know how uncomfortable you are. Oh, golly, I didn't even know them, and all of a sudden I'm discovering that they're addicted to pornography. Well, how do you deal with that? I mean, and so you know that that's probably not an appropriate thing to do, although people are not always appropriate, but nonetheless, it still is oftentimes in an emerging relationship something that might come out, but only when somebody feels safe in the fact that I'm safe with that, with you, and I really am grappling with that, and I really need help, okay? Now, so you don't understand that. There's something that happens here And this is like really, 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 really important, okay? Which means interpreted, this is important, okay? And you all remember this in the falling in love process. For those of you that are married, you already, all of you can relate to it. I call it the hypothetical conversation. You know, now we know each other, we've dated for a while, and now we have this hypothetical conversation, and it goes something like this. And it usually starts with, now, this is just hypothetical. Don't panic. This is just like hypothetical. But I'd like to, I'm just curious how you feel about this. What if we were to take this to the next level, which is like we've been dating, but now we're talking about the next level, which might be marriage, okay? You know, if we were to take it to the next level, hypothetically, you know, how many kids would we have? Would we have kids? How many would we have? Where would they go to school? You know, what would we do? About church, about this, about that, or whatever. You know, all the things that basically you really want to know the answers to, but you've never had the courage to bring it up into the context of the relationship. But what happens and on that event, and you all know this, this is like, you know, ABC, right? I mean, we all know this. What happens there is the pronouns change. Remember the I and the me? Now it turns to we and us. And everything changes then, because now you've taken ownership of the relationship. And the same thing needs to happen. And so, you know, it's sitting down with people. I think this is the greatest idea I've had in 45 years. Okay, I'm going to share with you. This is like the best, all right? But it actually, I mean, of all the ideas that I've had, and I have one every, you know, 23 seconds, actually, according to my wife, some of which are worth listening to and most of which are not. But Sue has this system now that I've discovered that if I say something once, she listens to it and nods, you know. If I say it, you know, three times within a month, she, you know, hears what it is that I'm saying. And it's not until, you know, like 6 months and I'm still talking about it that she says, okay, we need to sit down and talk about this, okay? So this is like ideas, you know, flow pretty frequently out of my lips, and most of them are absurd. But this one, you know, has probably changed the entire focus of our ministry. And it was, I was doing a capital funding campaign, which is a fundraising event, you know, for an organization. And I remember walking in, this would be somewhat typical of what I would do, as I said, okay, you know, if this project is going to be successful, let's imagine that we're going to come back 5 years from now or 3 years from now, and we've raised all the money that we needed to do this, and let's just say that it was incredibly successful. And if this thing was successful, who would you have imagined would have been, let's just imagine we're 5 years down and it's been successful, and we're looking backwards now, you know, who would have been involved? And they think about it, and they say, well, you know, if we were to achieve success here, I would think that, well, if I were to imagine, I would think that these people, these groups of people would be involved. They name a bunch of groups. And I call those critical groups. There are critical groups in your church. There are critical groups in your campus environment, where you work. You know, there's always groups of people that kind of shape things. And you know who they are. I mean, you could just sit down and say, okay, well, I can tell you right now who they are, you know. But first of all, there are groups of people. And within those groups, there are people that others look to for direction. You know, it's interesting. 95% of all the world are followers, which means that 5% are leaders. And what you're really trying to do is you're trying to find out who the leaders are in the various groups that are, you know, essentially critical to your success, at least as you perceive it outwardly. In other words, if we're going to have this vibrant campus ministry, you know, what groups of people would we presume would be critical to our success? And so they did that. And it's really kind of interesting, you know, this was a fundraising campaign, and so they're kind of looking at it like at the 35,000-foot level. You know, they're just kind of looking down and say, okay, yeah, rich people, that would be a group that would be, you know, critical to our success. And, you know, you keep trying to bring them down a little bit lower than that, but say, well, rich people, business people, church people, you know, church members, Baptists because we're a Baptist school, or Lutherans because we're a Lutheran school. I mean, they would be potential. And so they're kind of like being really all over the board. I said, okay, let's take it down to 20,000 feet. You know, when you talk about business people, what are you talking about? Well, you know, Christian ones versus non-Christians, right? Okay, now we've got two categories within that category. And then let's take it a little bit deeper. Let's get down to about 1,000 feet. Well, this was a Lutheran organization. And they said, well, and one of the groups that they identified, and we took them down through this process, and you need to do the same thing. But when we get down to here, they said, well, Lutheran members of Lutheran churches that are part of our association, you know, who own their own business or who are chief executive officers of a business. I said, okay, that's good. And they came up with like 63 names. All right, so now we have, and the way they got the names is they didn't know who they were. They just knew that they were out there. And so there's these congregations, I don't know how many of them there were, that we just actually said, you know, are there people in your church that meet this, you know, that meet this criteria? And usually it was somebody that we knew, which is going to be real important to the discussion later because it's one of the rules that we're going to be talking about. But it was somebody that was, you know, from that church, and they did the research, you know, on their own. They said, oh, yeah, well, we've got five people in our church that they're CEOs or whatever the case might be. And so we did all of that. We came up with 63 names. And then we took one other step, and we said, okay, we took these 63 names and put them in alphabetical order, and we, you know, if five of them were in this particular church, we handed each of the five people that, whose names were identified, we said, listen, you know, all we're asking you to do is, you know, are there people in this group that if you were, and they have the list of all 63 names. And we say, are there people in this group that if you were looking for counsel, you would go to these people? Okay? So what we're trying to identify is who is the movers and shakers in the group, right? We just want to know who they are. And so we looked at it. When we got them back, everybody did it immediately. When we got them back, if they had five or more people that said, you know, this is a person that I'd go to if I were looking for, you know, answers to a question that I was grappling with, then we went to those, and there, I think there were like 13 of them. And so here are the people that are the leaders, the opinion setters and so forth. So the next thing that we did was we set up a meeting to get together with those people, not to ask them for money, not to ask them for anything. We just wanted to talk with them. It would be, you know, who are the, you know, the top student leaders in our group? You know, we've got 100 people in our chapter. You know, if you were looking for advice, who would you go to? And I'd go to this person, this person, this person, this person. You know, many of you could take a church directory if you've been in the church for any length of time, and I'd give you a highlight pen. Say, okay, you know, just circle the names of the people that are kind of movers and shakers. When things happen in your church, these people are involved. When things don't happen, they're kind of noticeably absent. You know who they are. It wouldn't take more than, you know, 20 seconds or 30 seconds to do that for most churches of a nominal size. So the point is that we all know that they exist, right? You all know that they exist in your campus chapter. You know that they exist. Okay, now, the next thing we did was we invited them to a meeting where we told them we weren't going to ask them for anything. We just really wanted some advice and some counsel. And so we did that. We brought them all to a meeting, and a person that they knew invited them. So we were kind of building around this idea that, you know, people are going to be more likely to respond to somebody that they know rather than somebody that they don't know. And we kind of bring them to the table, and we have like a very informal meeting. And we ask the question, you know, in the meeting, you know, here's where it is we're going. This is what it is we feel led of the Lord to do. But, you know, we don't have a clue how to do it. Now, let me just tell you something. I have spent 45 years of my life pleading ignorance. Because I don't know all the answers. What I have learned in the course of my career, I've learned best by asking people. And I had an experience like this just probably 2 or 3 weeks ago. We're doing this big project in America. I know where, but it's really irrelevant. And so it's a campaign. They're trying to raise $9 million, and they hired my company to come, and they asked me to come over. And I said, sure, I'd be happy to come over. And I sat down with them, And I asked them the same question, you know, who are the movers and shakers, you know, in town? You know, I just really wanted to know that. And I remember going to one of them who was the president of a really large bank in this community. And he's a young guy. I mean, everybody's young to me anymore. You know, I'll be 70 years old next year, so everybody's a young guy anymore. But I go to this guy, and immediately we hit it off. And sometimes that happens, isn't it? You know, you've had the experience. You know, you just meet somebody, you like him immediately. And we had some common interests. I had a shirt that had a logo of a golf club that I'm a member of. And he said, "Oh, you golf?" I said, yeah, you too. Yeah, and we just started talking about golf stuff, you know, and so forth. And then he says, "What are you here for?" I said, "Well, listen, let me tell you why I'm here. I won't take too much of your time." I said, "You know, such and such a, you know, organization has hired us, and they want to do a campaign." He says, "Yeah, I knew that." And I said, "You know, I've done lots of these, you know, everywhere, all around the world. But, you know, I've never done one in this town, and I don't have a clue. I honestly don't have a clue what I should do. I mean, if you were me, how would you do this?" And he sat there, and I took out a legal pad. And this happens to me all the time. This isn't like a one-time event. This happens to me like once or twice a week, or more than that many times. He says, "Jared, here's what I do." He says, "First of all, you need a person up here." He says, but the key is that this is a farming community, and there are people that are people that shape what happens in this town. And, you know, there are farmers, a lot of farmers. And then we have a lot of people that work with the farmers. You know, they're the grain elevator people. They're the, you know, the suppliers to the farmers, you know, the seed salesmen, all those people. Then we have a strong insurance industry here, and that's it. And really, and then we've got the churches and here, you know, and he says, and so, and you need people, you know, who basically, you know, can represent you in each of those arenas. I said, "Well, you know, give me some ideas of like who would be a good person." And so he writes down on those six different blocks, or he puts the names of people. He says, "Now these people, if they begin involved, then you will have absolutely no problems. Because everybody looks to them for direction. And when, you know, if they're engaged, then, they're, you know, hey, it's a done deal." And I said, "Well, what about landmines?" Because, you know, I've been in enough communities where there are landmines and you don't know where they are. You know, would you like to go across the field? Across this field, there are 17 landmines. Okay, everybody know? All right, here's the field. Let's go. Who's going to go first? You say, "Not me. I'm not going to go." I mean, 17 landmines in this little field? No, I don't think so. But there's somebody that knows where they all are. I'm going to follow him. Because if he knows where they are, I don't think he wants to be blown up any more than I do. So I'm going to follow him. "Well, I don't know where the landmines anywhere are, but you know where they are. In your church, you know this is a place. I'm just not going to walk over there because I know that this one's just going to blow up from underneath. You know where they are. So where are they?" And so he says, "Now here are the landmines. Here's where they are." It's okay. And we talked for about, and I'm like taking, you know, notes. I mean, like big time notes. And so I walked back to the organization that we were working with, and I said, "Well," and we'd spent several hours that day talking to other groups, you know, with pretty much the same agenda. And I said, "Okay, here's the way we need to set up this campaign. First of all, the guy in the top needs to be the president of the bank. I think he'll do it. And then, and here's the organization, and he can get all those people involved in all those, you're kidding, he can do that? Yeah, no problem. He says, I can get them all. And then, you know, here where the landmines are." And, you know, it played out perfectly. You know, went to him, "Yeah, that's really great. I'd love to work with you, Jerry. This will be fun." You know, and I'm thinking, well, great. I'm glad it's going to be fun because I've been in a lot of them that weren't nearly all that much fun. And here are the people who need to be involved. And he got all, and they're all doing the thing, and they're raising more than they've ever thought they could possibly raise. But the point is that it was just, you know, asking people. Now, I have just come to a point in my life where I just ask a lot of questions. And people have the answers. And usually we come with an agenda, and that's oftentimes the case in development people, you know, people that kind of do the work that I do. We have an agenda. We need to raise money. Would you give some? And I basically have a 50-50 chance, and probably it's even not even that good. It's probably about a 10% chance that somebody's going to say yes to me. Because I didn't take the effort to build a relationship. I didn't take an effort to do anything else. I didn't take an effort to learn what it is that I needed to know in order to be able to do what it is. But the point is, sit down with people. You know, you get campus leaders. you know, in your group, you know, or church leaders in your group say, listen, this is my vision. This is what it is I want to see done. This is the way I want to see our community done. You know, I don't have a clue. I'm just your pastor. You know, and I mean, I know I have some gifts, and I'm not trying to minimize the situation, but the realities are, you know, if this is going to happen, it's going to happen because we've partnered together to see that it can happen. You know, if you were in my situation, what would you do? How would you go about doing this? And how many times have you had that conversation? Most organizations don't bother. We come with our agenda and hope that everybody's going to sign on. And in signing on, we've lost most of them, you know, who basically have more to offer than what... the last thing in the world I want to hear, you know, when I'm dealing with a client, you know, is after it's all over, after the campaign's over and somebody has done something really bad, you know, the last thing I want to hear is I could have told you that that was going to happen. I'm just like sitting here waiting for the train wreck, you know. I mean, I wonder when it's going to happen because you know it's going to happen and they all know it's going to happen. But if you don't ask them about it, they're not going to tell you. And I'm just saying, you know, can you help me to understand what it is that I shouldn't do? And I said, well, I'll tell you, yes, I can tell you what it is you shouldn't do. And they'll tell you, but only if you ask. And so we call those task force meetings, these informal meetings where you're just sitting down with people, you're just asking them questions and trying to get their ownership with you in what it is you're doing. Because you want them to know that this isn't I and me, it's not just Jerry's agenda, but this is we and us. This is something we're going to do together in an effort to try to reach, you know, goals that we've set for ourselves. So that's a really important part. So then we come to this point. Now, if talking about fundraising, you know, people may be making gifts all along the way here. So that's not, this doesn't represent, you know, somebody makes a gift. It may be in campus ministry, this is a person, you know, several of these people, you know, on this continuum have accepted the Lord. But this represents, you know, discipleship. I'm going to follow. It's people driving a stake in the ground and saying, you know, this is who I am. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to be committed to Jesus Christ the rest of my life, regardless of hell and high water. Nothing's going to stop me. You know, I'm going to be disappointed. I'm going to be frustrated. I'm going to be angry. I'm going to be upset. I'm going to be disillusioned. But the realities are I'm making this commitment before you and before God. This is my stake in the ground. That's what that represents. It's like I'm going to live with you the rest of my life, regardless of what it is that happens. It makes no difference whether you have cancer, whether you suffer, whether you're insane. I mean, whatever the case might be, this is the commitment that I'm making to you. Now, this is what happens next. There's actually two possibilities here. Now I'm living in relationship with you. And the centrality of our relationship is our relationship with Jesus Christ. That's kind of the ideal arrangement, right? This is marriages that really work together. This is another option. As I go through now life as a married man, Sue goes through life as a married woman, and we kind of go our separate ways. That this is just a step in the development of my personality. I got a driver's license. I was able to do certain things at certain ages. And at this age, I chose to get married. Now I'm going to go on and build a career because I've got that past me. And there are a lot of marriages that are that way. Now, I've been accused of a lot of things in the course of my life. And as you have, I mean, I'm like not any different than you are. And one of the things, if you wanted to say something that would really hurt me, okay, if you really want to say, I'm going to just really get, you know, then here's something that you could say, and it's been said to me before, and that is, people say, you know, Jerry, you're nothing more than a master manipulator. That you can get people to do what it is that they don't want to do. And that would really crush my spirit because that's not who I want to be. And it's, you know, that's like not only just, you know, putting a knife in my soul, but it's kind of turning it in the way that it's going to do maximum damage. That just is. But the question is that we have to deal with this in ministry. You know, to understand the difference between manipulation and non-manipulation. I mean, because it is an issue. It is something that comes up. I get it every, you know, not every day, but certainly very frequently in the course of my career. And here's, I think, you know, the scriptures, I love the James chapter 2. Well, I don't love it. But it's obviously a passage of scripture that we need to deal with, where James says in James chapter 2, verse 1, Do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. If somebody comes into your assembly dressed in fine clothes and has a big gold ring, there also comes in a poor man dressed in dirty clothes and probably doesn't really smell that well. And you say to the one dressed in the fine clothes, the guy dressed in the fine clothes with the gold ring, why don't you sit here? We've got a good place for you right here in the front of the congregation. But you say to the one that's dressed in dirty clothes and doesn't smell that well, why don't you just stand back there or maybe even sit underneath that footstool over there? And then James comes to the core of the issue in the next verse when he says, have you not made distinctions among yourselves, become judges with evil motives? That if you're pursuing people just for what it is you can get out of them, then you've probably been manipulative. And here's a better way to determine it. You know, if during this stage of the relational process, you expended a lot of energy, and so did she. I mean, was there anything you wouldn't have done for the person that you were falling in love with? I mean, is there anything that she could have asked you or he could have asked you that you wouldn't have considered, you know, very, very seriously? You know, if you know, that wouldn't obviously, you know, conflict with your values? Is there anything you wouldn't do? I mean, no, my gracious. I mean, she'd asked me to drive to Anchorage, Alaska to get her a, you know, a snow cone. You know, somehow I'd have figured out a way to do it, you know. I mean, who wouldn't have? I mean, we all would have done that. We spent an immense amount of energy to secure this relationship, all of us who have married. But if you don't spend as much money sustaining the relationship as you did to acquiring the relationship, you probably have been manipulative. See, there are two steps in this process. This takes energy, and so does this. And so does this. And so it's very, very important for us to make sure that we're doing the things that we need to do to sustain relationships. And in relationships, you know, people are responsive because they know that you care. You've experienced that, and they've demonstrated that in the course of your life and your work. So, yeah, that's a kind of an interesting way to remember, you know, the whole process of building relationships. And the one thing that I never learned in seminary was, well, how do you do this? I mean, how do you go about doing building relationship stuff? You know, I mean, I understand that I need that, and I know how important it is in my ability to be able to accomplish my mission initiatives. But how do you really do that? And so, you know, this, you know, really has helped me over the years to help organizations to do that. Now, what time do we take our break? 3. Okay. So it's 2:30, 2:20. Y'all doing okay? Do you want to ask some questions or response? You know, let's get, I mean, do you think this is like really the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life? And why am I here? And how can I get out of here without anybody noticing that I'm going to walk past everybody else to get out the front door? I mean, what speak to me? Well, yeah, let's just talk about, you know, the notes here. Let's go to the defining your dream part. The big picture that I'm talking about here is if your ministry was totally successful in fulfilling its ministry, you know, and then, you know, ask the question, what would it look like? In other words, let's say that you have a teenage group in your church, you know, teenagers 13 to 18. What would you like those 13 to 18-year-old look like when they're 23 and 28? That's what I want by the big picture. What would you want a senior citizen, if I'm in your church and I'm 70 years old and I'm part of your congregation as well, what would you want me to look like when I'm 80? You know, what would you want a young married couple with just little children, you know, just little, you know, toddlers right now, you know, how would you want them to look like, you know, spiritually and in every other way, and how about their kids and how about the relationship with their kids? I mean, those are things that we don't typically talk about. How would we want a student that's in our, you know, our college campus now to look like not just 4 years from now by the time that they leave, but 10 or 15 years later as they're relating to the church, as they're relating to people, as they're relating, you know, how do we want them to look? Because until we know what it is that we want them to look like, then we don't have a plan to get them from where it is they are to where it is that they need to be. because there's an assessment. This is where I think they are. You know, here are the things, the steps that we're going to take. And not necessarily that that's going to generate the results, but you have a greater likelihood of achieving results when you have a plan to get there. So that's the big picture. And what it will require is kind of, you know, well, you know, these are the steps that we need to take. And it's getting, you know, people together, people that are in your nursery, people that are in your, you know, we do it, and we do this a lot in a lot of school classes, especially in elementary and secondary schools where we spend a lot of our time, is what is a third grader, you know, a third grader graduating from, you know, the third grade going into the fourth grade, you know, what do we want them to look like at the end of the third grade? Well, I'll guarantee you there's not many third grade teachers that have ever asked that question. But stop and think about this. If you were a parent of a third grader and you go in to talk to the teacher and the teacher says, now listen, this is what we want your student to graduate. These are the objectives that we're striving for. And they're not just educational objectives. I mean, they're personality development, you know, objectives. There are interrelationship objectives. In other words, how do they relate to people? How do they relate to their peers? How do they relate to older people? How do they relate to, you know, younger people and so forth? And all the things that you want. Now, I think if I'm a third grade parent and I've got a third grader, I'm saying, well, wow, yeah, that's what I want them to look like too. And maybe you say, well, help us. You know, right now, in these five or six key areas that we've demonstrated where we want to be involved in your life. I mean, we're going to be involved in the educational process, but, you know, in these other areas that we think are important to just child development, not necessarily, you know, spiritual development in this particular case, if you're not a Christian school, but you still want, you know, obviously you have objectives, and most of them, you know, relate to not only intellectual development, but the way they relate socially and in the world of which they're a part. You know, where would you rate your child on a 1 to 10 scale right now? Just, you know, help us to understand, you know, where the needs are. You know, everybody can do that. They're helped, and it helps you. But now you're on an agenda. You've got a plan. Now, the likelihood of that happening without a plan is almost infinitesimal. I mean, some of it will happen. But if you're not concerned about their social development and how they relate to other people, it's probably not going to happen. They're still, I mean, a bully's going to be a bully, you know, somebody who basically, you know, kicks dogs is going to continue to kick dogs, and, you know, unless you do something about it. I mean, the whole point is that oftentimes things don't happen because we don't plan for them to happen. And I realized that, you know, that was the stress point in transforming culture, is that they felt, you know, we're creating environments, you know, to cause people to make decisions. And I mean, I can't make a decision for them. I mean, there may be still people who would kick dogs despite the fact that I didn't want them to, you know. But the point is, at least they know it's wrong, you know, that you shouldn't do that. And if that's all that ends up, it's still better than not having nothing happen. Whatever you want to achieve will be enhanced to the degree that you build relationships. In other words, you know, it's easier to get people to cooperate when you're in relationship with them than just telling them what to do and not engaging them in the whole discussion.
Kind of introduction.
Yes, right. And actually, if you go down into the second point, you know, success is accomplishing what it is that our mission, that is things that are consistent to our mission. The definition of development is the things that we do to build rational relationships with others. The characteristics of fulfilling relationships, we talked about those. The relationships versus arrangements, we talked about that. Emotion versus rational, we talked about that. The relational continuum, that's what's on the board. So basically, we were following our notes without you knowing it. It's kind of sneaking up to you on the backside and say, okay, here's where it is we're going. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, and this is the other thing another thing that I didn't learn in seminary, and that is that not everybody that is in your church or in your ministry is in the same relationship as the person next to them in line. See, the mistake that we make is that we treat everybody like they're the same. it would be easy for me to treat you as, well, you're all college people. Well, I know you're not all college people, but I know some of you are pastors and some of you are in other ministries and so forth. But you know, I'd make the assumption that you're all the same, or that you graduated in a degree in development and you know more about this than I do. I don't know that, but I'm assuming that you don't. So I'm just going to tell you what it is. I mean, so we make assumptions, don't we? We do it in direct response marketing. If we're going to, mail a letter out, or we're going to send a newsletter out, do we distinguish between the people that receive the newsletter or the letter? No, we just send them all the same letter. And we get a 3% response, and we're excited because that's 1% above the national average. But are you happy with that? That only meant that 98% of the people that got the letter, or 97% of the people that got the letter, didn't want to answer it because they're not in relationship with you. So we go to church and we preach a sermon, and we just assume that you're in the same place spiritually as you, and you're in the same place spiritually as the two of them, and you're not. I mean, you're all different. You're grappling with your baggage. I'm grappling with my baggage, and you're ministering to us. And you can't assume that we're all in the same place. But we treat people that way. And we do it, more because we don't know, well, what else would we do? I mean, I don't know where people are. And again, there are some things that we need to know. Let's say, here's a person here, okay? This is a person in your church. There are two things that you need to know about this person. All right? So this is anybody. It could be you. The first thing that you'd want to know is what I call I'm just trying to think of the word. It's a vestiture. Now, let me explain what vestiture means. You all know that probably, but vestiture is the people that have invested in your ministry. I mean, they're engaged. If I have a parent, if I'm a parent of a third grader of a Christian school, then I'm vested. I mean, in other words, this kid's in my school, my kid is in your school, and so I'm invested in what it is that you're doing. So you have two choices here, vested or not vested. So that's pretty easy. Now over here, you have what I call cultivation levels. In other words, everybody is in a varying degree of cultivation in relationship to your organization. Now, here's an interesting way to do this. If you're raising money, this would be a pretty interesting example. Okay, let's assume that, the roof of your church blows off in a storm. Or something happens in your ministry that could be critical to its ability to continue. That could be resolved with $50,000, let's say. Something happened. We can't, if we don't address this, we're going to lose the opportunity of ministry impact. And so we have to, we have to raise $50,000. Okay. So everybody's with me so far. Okay. Now let's just say that you're sitting down now. You've got the directory of your church. The people that are on your database that support your ministry. I mean, you have an idea who these people are. And I ask you, I said, okay, who are the first people you're going to contact? And you already know. I mean, you know immediately, I'm going to call these seven people. I mean, this is like a no-brainer. Okay, yeah, I'm going to call this person, this person, this person. Because whenever you call them, they always are willing to help. If, in fact, there's a legitimate need. They're just always there for you. These people are your key people. They may be your key donors. But these are people who just love you to death, and they're going to do anything that they can. They may not be able to give you money, but they can go out and put shingles on the roof, and they can do all kinds of things. Count on me. I'm going to be there. I said, okay, and let's say you raise $35,000 from those people, just to use the illustration, to keep the illustration going consistently. Well, then I say, okay, well, now we need some more people. So now let's make up another list of the next group of people we're going to talk to. So you say, okay, yeah, I can do that. So you put down some other names. Now, they're not as good as the first names. But they love you to death, and they're gonna, if they can help, they will. You kind of know that, and so forth, and so intuitively you know that, and so you put up another list and say, okay, these people are gonna call them next. So okay, we do that. Now we've raised $45,000, but we still need $5,000 more to raise. So I said, okay, go back to the list. You got all these other people you need to call, and so you can put another list of names in. And now you're at $49,900, so you need to raise another $100. And so I said, okay, come on, let's get the rest of the list. And the rest of the list is, you know, just people that you may not know really well, but you have names and addresses. So you follow me so far? Okay, let me suggest that the first names, the first group of names that you had, we'll call them A prospects, okay? And then there were, the next group would be a B prospects, all the B prospects. The C, the next group would be the C, and the third would be the D's. And we know that this is true. We know that in our databases we have A, B, C, D prospects. Intuitively we know that. You have A, B, C, D church members. You have A, B, C, D campus, you know, chapter members. I mean, you could, you know, kind of, you know in your head who are the A's, who are the B's, who are the C's, who are the D's. The D's are the kind of the hangers-on. They show up when they want to show up, but they don't always show up consistently. You know who they are. But you know that they're there. You may not know who they are, but I think most of you probably know who they are. Now, my first job in development, I was a vice president for advancement at Grace College and Theological Seminary. And we had 47,000 people on our database. That's like a good-sized database, you know, at that time. This was back in the early 80s. And this group of people were giving $475,000 a year. They're giving close to $500,000 a year. Okay, so now I have this new job, and I haven't got a clue what it is I'm going to do. So the first thing I did was I went to our IT guy, and I wanted a printout of all the people on the database, and these are the fields that I wanted to be able to look at. And so he gave me this printout, and it's, remember, the long green paper with the pinholes, and it's like that thick, you know. And I bring it home to my house, and I put it next to my favorite chair. And for about 2 weeks, I'm going through every single name on that on those lists, all 47,000 names, because there are certain things that I was looking for. Are they donors? And what's their relationship to the institution? You know, things like that. You know, where do they live? I had a zip code address. I mean, there are all kinds of things that I was looking at. And I was making all these mental notes. And then at the end of all of that process, I said, because people are saying, well, we need to add more people to our database. I said, you know, we may need to add more people to our database, but that's not going to be our primary initiative. Because why would you, if you're not doing a good job with what it is that you have, you know, why should you just exacerbate the problem by adding more names that you're not doing a good job with? That doesn't make an awful lot of sense. So let's focus on what we have before we go after getting new people. And they said, okay, that makes sense. So we came up with this little simple acronym. And literally, the reason why I'm here today is because of this acronym right here, AID. Now, this is going to be a bit more complex than I'm going to explain it, only because there's a little bit more to this than what it is I'm going to take the time to talk about right now. But AID, now an acronym, every letter stands for something else, okay, right? So A stands for attendance. I stands for involvement. D stands for donation. Okay? So we said, okay, what we had done is we'd looked at people that were donors, you know, people that were big supporters, and we noticed that there were commonalities between all of them on the list. All of them attended things when things happened. You know, whenever there was an event on campus, whenever there was an event in the region where they lived, you know, like an alumni meeting or something like that, these people showed up. You know, they were always there whenever there was something going on, or often there. And they were all involved in some way. In other words, they just got engaged. They did things. They served on committees and task forces. They were volunteers. They were just doing things on behalf of the institution. And thirdly, we noticed that they all were donors, or many of them were donors. So, now follow me. We said, well, okay, if they've done all three, they equal an A. If they've done two of the three, they equal a B. If they've done one of the three, they equal a C. And if they've done none of the three, they equal a D. So now we looked at our database, and we went through every single name on the database, and we said, okay, we have A people, B people, C people, and D people. And then we started analyzing gifting patterns, you know, looking at this particular acronym, And we discovered that there's less than a 10% likelihood that a D prospect, given that situation, is going to do anything to support the organization. Less than 10%. I mean, once in a while, yeah, I'll do that, and so forth. And usually it's because they're just coming in, they're not really have been there for a long time, so they're just naturally working through the opportunities that are being presented to them. There's about a 30% likelihood that a C prospect would say something, about a 60% likelihood that a B prospect would do something, and about a 90% likelihood that an A prospect would do something. Now, I have been involved in this ministry of development and fundraising and all the other things associated with it for 43 years. And I can't handle rejection. I mean, like, it's really tough for me. If you were angry with me and if you left because you just think he's a jerk and I don't know why I'm sitting here, you know, I'd feel really bad and I'd probably come and talk to you and say, listen, I'm really sorry if I did anything that was offensive, but that's really not who I am. I mean, so here's a guy that doesn't handle rejection really well. I mean, when people reject me, I want to go in a corner and die. Or I want to, you know, I keep looking at this, you know, I'm not even worth the piece of ground that I'm occupying. I mean, I really get really bad. I mean, and so here's a guy, you know, that basically doesn't handle rejection really well, who for 43 years has been talking to people, you know, about supporting organizations in a variety of different ways. And your question might logically be, well, how in the world have you survived that long? And the answer is that I have chosen never to go to these people. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't do things with these people. I'm just not going to go because the odds are that I'm going to get beaten over the head, you know, and I just don't like being beaten over the head. I'm not a masochist. So I kind of, you know, but I don't mind spending a lot of my time here because I know that I'm going to get a warm response. I mean, people aren't going to shoot me. They may not accept what it is that I'm asking them to consider, but the realities are they're going to be much more likely to support me because, you know, they are better cultivated. And so what we did in those years, and there were 4 years that we really worked on this, and we kind of developed the systems and we were able to manage them, you know, pretty successfully. And what it is that we did was we were focusing on moving D's to C's, C's to B's, and B's to A's, and then sustaining the A's. That was kind of our development program. And 4 years later, the same number of people, the 48,000 that were on the database, 4 years later, they were giving $475,000, now they're giving $2.5 million. The same people. I mean, we're not talking, there wasn't an increase in the database, we didn't focus on that, there was some natural increase, but only because of people enrolling in the school that were new. But we weren't making any effort to try to acquire donors, we were trying to make sure that we were exacting from the people that were there. We wanted to engage them and build relationships with them. And we were very, very strategic about it. And it won an award that I didn't even know that we were participating in a contest, but we were submitting reports back to an organization. We won a national award, and all of a sudden I'm being asked to speak about what it is that we did here that was so, at the time, was cutting edge. Nobody had even thought about doing this. And so, you know, I'm now traveling around the country, you know, talking to people about, well, what we did that made a significant difference. And that's really why I'm here today, is because something that we were kind of just working on and struggling on and dealing with because we really wanted to do a good job. You know, once we figured that out, then everything changed. Now, one of the things that I talk about in Transforming Culture, which again, created a little bit of stir, but I mean, hopefully it was a book, if nothing else, that, you know, it caused people to think. Even if it got them angry, I was okay with that, I guess, you know, but, you know, not handling rejection really well, I still dealt with it. But AID, we had to, you could include, you might draw the conclusion that everybody in the church is an A prospect, right? Because everybody's attended the church, it's in the church. At least one time. You know, they're all involved probably at some point in time in doing something, you know, and they probably have made donations at somewhere along the way. So you might say, well, gee, everybody in our church is an A prospect. Well, and then you're saying, no, I know that's not true. So we kind of reinterpreted it, and we interpreted it this way. That somebody was an A, it was people that attended 30 to 52 weeks a year. In other words, if they weren't on vacation, if they weren't on holidays, you know, if they weren't sick, you know, then on Sunday morning they're going to be in church. And you say, well, that's fair. I mean, because you'll have people that come twice a year, you know, Easter and Christmas, and, you know, they say, well, yeah, I'm a member of that church in good standing, you know. Well, in good standing means that I show up on Christmas and Easter, you know. And you're thinking, well, I'm not sure that we see it the same way that you do, but nonetheless, that's the way they view it. Involvement means that they're using their giftedness to enable you to fulfill your mission. In other words, it acknowledges the fact that everybody has gifts that have been given to them by God. And then one of the challenges, obviously, in working in the church is how does this person use their giftedness to further the cause of the kingdom? Oh, okay. And then donation is that they're tithers. Or, and you can take that in the strictest sense of the word, that they give 10% of their income, which 3.5% of people that are Christians in America do. Okay? Or they have a regular pattern of giving. This isn't the biblical definition, but nonetheless, if you need some kind of soothing here, that essentially that you have a pattern. Maybe it's 500 a month or 1,000 a month or whatever the case might be, but you have a pattern. And let's call that tithing, but that still only represents about 30% of the people in America, in our country, which means that 70% aren't, or 95% aren't, okay? Now if you're looking at A, B, C, or AID, you know, you're going to say, well, maybe we've got about 5% of the people in our congregation that are A's. We probably have 30 that are B's. We probably have 60 that are, you know, C's, and maybe 10 that are D's. But if you knew that, you know, then what would you do? You know, well, maybe people aren't involved because they can't figure out, you know, I can't work in the nursery and I don't sing and I can't be an usher. You know, the choir's out, you know, the nursery's out, and, you know, we all have all the ushers that we need. And so, you know, there's just no place for us. And so they're never involved because they're never, you know, we're not creating opportunities for people to be able to use their giftedness. Well, maybe I don't even know what my giftedness is. Well, maybe you need to do something about that. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, what can we do strategically to move people up a ladder? And that's, and listen, this has not a thing to do with money. But the same thing is true, that the likelihood of your sermon touching the heart of a D prospect is about less than 10%. Now you say, well, the Spirit of God can do anything. You're right, and I believe that too. But if you're just looking at likelihood, first of all, it's unlikely that they're going to be there. And if they are there, it's probably going to be unlikely that they're going to be sitting there eagerly awaiting something that's going to convict them of their sin so that they can change their lives. And there's about a 30% likelihood that a C would, and about 60% likelihood that a B would. And you know where the A's, they're all sitting in the front row taking notes, saying, Pastor, what's next? You know, what do I do now? What do I do now? What do I do now? How can I be involved now? And by simply just changing the way we do things, we increase likelihood. Now, I hope that's not offensive to you. But the realities are, it just is common sense to me. And I think, you know, the same thing is true with the things that you're doing in campus ministry. You know the kids that are going to be there and they're going to do things. You know the kids that aren't going to be there. And, you know, how do we bring them up a ladder? Because we want them to become, you know, in love with God. We want them to be servants. We want them to give of themselves. And it seems to me that there just are some very, very important practical things that we can do. So if you go back to your notes, here we go. Meeting people where they are. Vestiture and cultivation. Well, the vestiture, we talked about vested and non-vested. Cultivation, you know, A, B, C's and D's. Objectifying the subjective. In other words, How do you objectify people? How do we bring it to a point where we can deal with it? Because until you can objectify a problem, you can't deal with it. You know, you can raise money, but if you don't know what you're raising your money for, then the realities are you're not going to have much success. But in this case, the AID acronym, the application of the AID acronym, the predictability patterns, all that is part of what it is that we've talked about, and all that is in your notes. Now, we're going to come back. We're going to take a break. And we're going to come back. And I promise you, I'm not going to keep you to 5:30. So that's the good news, okay? I mean, it's not because I couldn't go to 5:30. It's because what I want to share with you, I can share before, you know, we can probably, if you come back at, what is the break until 3:30? 20 minutes? You come back in 20 minutes. I promise that we'll have you out of here probably by 4:15, okay? And so we won't keep you, you don't have to stay until 5:30. And if you want to talk after that till 5:30, I'm happy to sit here and talk to you until 10 o'clock tonight. So it's not an issue of me or anyone else, but it's, you know, let's just cover as much as we can here.